You've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
What's up, Launch Streeters? Tamara here, your host and innovation enabler. You know, learning from your failures suck. Actually, let me say that differently. That's not quite right. Failure hurts, but learning from it is integral to success and definitely integral to innovation. And what's great is if someone else fails and you get to learn from it, it's a free lesson. And I think in today's age, especially with just how much transparency and just conversation and social media that we have, we can see other people's failures and we can dissect them and learn from them. And that's exactly what Kyle Murray did with the epic failure back in the day of Crystal Pepsi. Now, some of you may not be old enough to know about it, so go look it up online. In fact, I'll put a link in the show notes. Kyle wrote this whole article about it. This is why we actually reached out to him, because it was fascinating to see this big, amazing launch and then the whole thing just fizzle out. And Kyle dug deep into understanding why it failed and how we can learn the most valuable lessons from their experience. And we talked about how you should never assume your customers understand the why behind your innovation. You got to let them know why what you did matters to them. We also talked about why out-innovating your customer is one of the biggest traps you can fall into. I think this part is particularly important because I think a lot of us, even in the innovation space, are constantly pushing for new innovation, but we got to be mindful of what our customers want and are actually ready to adopt from us. How far forward can we push them, or is it too far and they're going to back away from us? It's a fine balance. So we talk a lot about this outpacing, moving past your customer, and why behavioral economics has a lot to do with innovation. Now, Kyle Murray is the vice dean at the Alberta School of Business and a professor of marketing. And he's on Inside Launchery today to give us some incredible insights. Let's do this. Kyle, thank you so much for being here. I'm looking forward to digging into this conversation.
Oh, my pleasure. Happy to be here.
All right. What's the one thing that we would be surprised to learn about you?
Well, it's always a tough question. It probably depends on what you know me from or where you know me from. But I think one thing that surprises a lot of people is that I'm a big fan of both opera and mixed martial arts.
Oh, those don't typically go. Do you have them in the same place? Do they go together?
They don't. I don't think there's a lot of crossover between those two markets. So I think my friends I go to the opera with would probably be surprised that I am a fan of mixed martial arts and vice versa.
That's fine. Now, I have to ask, so give me one thing about each that make those two rise to the top.
Yeah, they're probably completely different in what I enjoy about them. What I really like about opera is it's an old art form. It's I find it very relaxing. You kind of know more or less what's going to happen. There's not a lot of surprises in the plot. It takes the, it's probably somebody's going to die in the end. It's going to take them a long time to die and sing some songs about it. Right? Whereas mixed martial arts is much more high energy, very much adrenaline driven. I did some martial arts as a kid, and so I, enjoy the technique and the skill of it. I think in both those cases, those are things that I could never see myself doing, singing on a stage in front of thousands of people or fighting in a cage. but it's fun to watch other people do it.
Not on your bucket list of
no,
skydive, sing in front of an opera, and fight in a cage.
Some things are better to watch than to do.
That's right. So I want to dive right in because you dissected why Crystal Pepsi was a massive innovation failure. So I just want to set the stage for our listeners. I want to hear why, but really kind of dig into Crystal Pepsi, what it was and why it failed. I've been like chomping at the bit to have this conversation because I remember that very vividly and how massively it failed. So share that story with us. Let's start there and then we'll dig into kind of the details about it.
Okay. I mean, the fact that you and I both remember that fairly vividly dates us a little bit,
Yeah, just a little.
which is what made it an interesting study as well, is because a lot of people, especially the younger generation, our students here at the university, have really no idea about it at all. But it, essentially, it was launched in 93. They spent a lot, Pepsi spent a lot of money launching it.
So much.
They had Van Halen playing Right Now in a Super Bowl commercial.
That's right. Yes.
It was a big
You're
push.
You're bringing back memories, Kyle. There's so many memories.
Yeah. So you know, it was a big marketing effort, and the idea was really something we're seeing more of today, which is people don't want a lot of additives in products, and one of those additives is the caramel colored dye. And so they'd take that out, they'd make it clear, they'd make it a little cleaner, and they thought it would be a $1 billion brand within a couple of years.
I mean, that sounds very on point, right, for those listening. Though that what Kyle's saying is really sounds like, yes, that is exactly what our consumers want. We're going to give them what they want.
Right. And that's why it makes for such an interesting kind of case study, or for us kind of an illustration of the work that we've been doing, is because it made a lot of sense if you're sort of a rational consumer, maybe, or more likely a rational product designer. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't explain itself. It's not clear when you look at it or see it why anyone who enjoys Pepsi that's caramel colored would want to trade that in for Pepsi that's clear. And if you don't enjoy caramel colored Pepsi, why would you enjoy it if it's clear? So it was a product that kind of sounds, you know, you could hear in a brief or a pitch, it sort of makes some sense in that boardroom. But then you get to the actual consumer, and they just don't see the need.
That's so interesting, because, like, doesn't it make you wonder? And I've been a part of these conversations. I've been in innovation for, you know, like you, like a long time. I think it's been 25 years since I graduated college. And one of the things that always struck me was what made sense in the conference room, or even in a focus group, doesn't always make sense in the real world. Because I'm going to imagine, I wasn't on the Crystal Pepsi project, I've done other work with them, but I have to imagine that in the conference room and in those focus groups, they spent a lot of time and money on that stage, the development stage, and that it sounded right in there.
Yeah. And this is the kind of the pitfall of small samples, whether that sample is the group of people you work with that are innovating a product, or a small group of consumers you're talking to in a focus group. If you want to sell a product like Crystal Pepsi to millions of people, then the opinions of a handful of people are just not enough to really understand how it's likely to be received. And it's very easy to get into groupthink, especially in design teams. You kind of start to think about a problem the same way, and you're much more knowledgeable than the average consumer about the product. You're much more intensely interested in it. In other words, you're not a lot like your average consumer when it comes to thinking about that product.
Do you think, I kind of have two questions here. Do you think, so one of the things you're saying is, okay, so be careful of that small group think feedback to make big decisions, and especially for something that should affect or be a product for millions of people, many people. Do you think also there's a failure or a challenge that we can learn from in how they launched it? Because it was they made such a massive to-do out of it in a very one-way communication style. Do you think that impacts it too? Because I kind of wonder, had they launched it with a soft launch where people were tasting it and testing it and, I don't know, doing different things with it, that would have maybe they would have found their niche doing it that way.
So, yeah, that's exactly what we're interested in is we're not so interested in, you know, why something fails as we are in how could we make it succeed? What else could we do that would maybe help consumers more easily adopt this product? And so, speaking very generally, I'll get just a little bit of behavioral science on you, but very generally, this is what we tend to refer to as a schema congruity problem. So, a schema is basically a pattern of thought or behavior that organizes categories of information in our minds and some of the relationships among them. So, for example, we have an idea of what cola should look like and what cola should taste like. And we do, for most of the things in the world, have some kind of schema about them, how we expect them to be. When things are a little bit different, so maybe you add cherry flavor to your Pepsi, that a little bit of schema incongruity, a bit different than what you'd expect, makes us curious. But when it gets too far away from what we expect, we start to get anxious about it.
So in this case, in Crystal Pepsi, they were too far away from it.
Right.
And that way it got, well, confusing or incongruent for consumers. This sounds like a tangent. I'm going to go to milk for a second, but I want to ask you this, because what you're saying, I think, relates to a conversation I was having yesterday. And I was listening to this interview on, I think it was NPR, I'm not sure now, but they were talking about how the dairy industry is going on this battle to own the word milk, so that things like flax and oat and all these other ones that are calling themselves milk can't call themselves milk. That's the battle they're taking on.
Right.
And what I think with what you're saying with schema is part of the reason those things are called milk is because it allows us to understand what to do with them. I mean, if you called it flax extract, I wouldn't know what to do with it, or flax juice. But when you put milk on it, I go, oh, I put it in my – it's like milk. I put it in my cereal. I put it in my coffee. So it can work the other way too, right?
Well, that's – yeah. So if you put yourself in the shoes of, you know, the flax or almond producers, what they're doing essentially is making it easier for you, except drinking flax extract, which most of us are going to recoil from, by calling it flax milk, which we tend to have fairly positive associations with. So they're essentially enabling us to better understand what it is they're selling. Now, that can be a problem when you taste the flax milk. If it's something completely different than you expect, that can be a problem. But it does help people kind of, it does reduce that anxiety people feel when you talk about you should really drink some flax extract.
Yeah, to me it's so important, particularly when you have a really far out there new invention of any kind, to give your customer, your consumer, an anchor to understand how to use it. Otherwise, the learning curve is just too hard. But I want to go back to Crystal Pepsi for a second. So quick question, how long did it take for them to realize it was a failure and pull it? I feel like it was really fast, but I don't remember the timeline.
It was relatively fast. I think within a year, they knew that it wasn't selling. And I think within 3 years so launched in 93, I think by around 95, 96, it was gone.
That is fast in the kind of big company world. So
yeah, and that was holding on to it. I mean, really, I think it was done within probably 3 to 6 months.
Right. Well, you can't just stop a line, right? There are things in manufacturing that have to happen. So schema is one of them. What are the other lessons that we as innovators need to think about coming out of the Crystal Pepsi and kind of that whole case study?
So really, it's based in this idea of schema congruity. And if it's moderately incongruent, it's okay. When it gets extremely incongruent, or what we sometimes call like a radical innovation, then it becomes problematic. And what our research has sort of been able to demonstrate is that if you can enable understanding, and there's a few different ways to do this, but it's what we call an enabler, something that connects in a semantic way, something that makes sense to people when you connect it to the product, that makes it easier to understand. So your example of flax milk is a great, great example. When it's flax extract, people feel anxious about it.
Right.
But when it's flax milk, you kind of enable that understanding of, okay, so this is like milk. I put it in my coffee. I can put it on my cereal. It's wholesome. It should taste good. Those kinds of things. So really what we're looking at is how do you create enablers that could make people better enjoy or be more accepting of the product, ultimately less anxious about it.
Can you give us an example from your research of one that did it well, like I guess moderately, and one that went a little too radical?
So we kind of create some of our own products. So we want to be able to test things from the ground up without a whole lot of brand built in. So Pepsi was unique that way. We actually set up a taste test booth. Two summers ago, Crystal Pepsi was relaunched just for, I think, about 5 or 6 weeks. Not many people knew about it. So I bought up most of the Crystal Pepsi here in town.
They were like, it's a wild success in this one hot spot.
That's right. It was like disappearing from grocery stores here in Alberta.
Right.
So we set up our own taste test booth. And we ran different versions of it. And one of the conditions or versions we ran was we were telling everyone this is a new cola. We would either give them the caramel colored regular Pepsi or the Crystal Pepsi. But then in a different set of conditions, we would also say, when we gave them the Crystal Pepsi, it's made with natural spring water. And that was our way, sort of like flax milk, of explaining why it's clear, why it doesn't look different. And what we found is, like the original Crystal Pepsi launch, people don't like Crystal Cola if you don't give it any explanation. But that little bit of explanation, that little bit of an enabler to understand, helped people kind of latch onto it. One of the other products we created that didn't have, you know, wasn't involved with any real brand, was we created a green vitamin coffee. And green coffee, to most people, sounds fairly abhorrent. You don't want anything to do with a green coffee. And we can't make green coffee as acceptable as black coffee. But when we told people it was vitamin-enriched coffee, they liked it a lot
better. Totally fine with it, yeah.
And they did just regular green coffee. And we did something similar with smartphones, and we've tried a few other products. Essentially, what it comes down to is, if you're going to do something that's radical, it's green coffee or it's a smartphone that feels like it's made out of cardboard, then you have to give them a good reason for why you're doing that. And it can't be complex. It can't be a long explanation. It has to be something quick, like spring water, milk, vitamin added.
You know, it's interesting. So I was at the grocery store the other day, and I happen to like all the green juices and presses and all that stuff. So I'm probably more knowledgeable than your average consumer on in that one little area. And there's a new one that have come out, or a new category, that's vinegar-based. And I happen to love vinegar. I know that's totally weird, but I do. I would drink it out of a bottle if I could. But and I get the benefits of it. I do the apple cider, a tablespoon a day thing, right? So I got there and I was like, oh, this makes perfect sense. But I was standing next to this woman who was looking at the case, and she looked at it and she was like, vinegar? Weird. And then she just walked away. And I was like, huh, I bet she doesn't understand. And there was nothing on the packaging that said, this is why vinegar base versus a water base is going to benefit you. So I kind of am starting to sense that, like, it was missing that enabler that you talked about,
right,
that made people go. I mean, the consumer had to work really hard to understand it. I happen to have done the heavy lifting accidentally, but if I hadn't, right, I would have had her response.
That's right. And I mean, what we know is, in general, consumers won't work really hard to understand it.
No, why should they? They have a million choices.
That's right. So they're going to give it a quick look, and if it doesn't make any sense, they're going to move on. So yeah, that's another great example. You look at it on the shelf and you say, oh, vinegar, I understand the benefits of that. That would put you in a small segment in the world.
Yeah.
Most people are going to go, gross.
Right.
Right. And, but again, if you can give them, if you can tie that in, whether it's, you know, it's the health benefit, or it's, more environmentally friendly, or whatever it is. And the other thing I should point out is, it's much better if it's true.
Oh, right? Sure.
So,
yeah.
With Crystal Pepsi, what we did was say it's made with natural spring water. Well, Crystal Pepsi wasn't, so that wouldn't have worked for them. People would have quickly found out it wasn't, and it would backfire. But if you can highlight something about the product that is true, and that's the reason why, then I think you can get the message across pretty effectively. What happens sometimes in the design group is, you're thinking about it so much, it becomes obvious to you that it's green because it has,
right,
vitamins. Or we've added vinegar because vinegar has health benefits, and everybody knows that because,
right,
you know, it's so obvious.
Because we do. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of that challenge of internal innovation that never touches the consumer before you launch, which is part of Crystal Pepsi's problem, aside from focus groups. But to your point, I mean, focus groups are really biased. There's a lot of issue with focus groups. It's so interesting to me. So there was a part in an article that you wrote about Crystal Pepsi that I wanted to highlight, because I think in innovation, we often talk about how important it is to keep up with change and innovate and innovate and innovate. And I don't disagree, but you had a little bit of a different perspective on part of it too. And you wrote that even though companies are constantly innovating, that people struggle to keep up with the many changes that innovation can bring. Almost like we're out innovating our consumers, is kind of how I read that. Will you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely true. This goes back to the basic sort of product adoption curve. And we tend to focus a lot on early adopters, getting people excited, getting the product moving. And those early adopters, they like innovation. But the rest of that curve,
right, the mainstream,
especially the back half of that curve, they don't like innovation. Right? People don't like change. And generally, you know, psychologically, we're not good with change. And yet we're in a world now where the innovation is happening at an incredibly rapid pace from the consumer perspective.
Do you think that that's because we're so busy trying to out I call it the ER trap. It's like I'm trying to be a little bit better, a little bit stronger, a little bit faster. You know, like I look at the razors aisle in the grocery store, right, or cereals, right? To me, those are great examples in our everyday lives that it's like, you know, 10 grams of fiber, 15 grams of fiber, two blades, three blades. Is it because we're really trying to compete with our customers versus innovate in a way that makes sense for our markets?
Yeah. I mean, I think what you can see it slightly different ways. I mean, some companies are just innovating for the sake of innovating and the innovation isn't that good. But you take kind of a more positive view on it. What most companies are trying to do is innovate because they want to make a better product that they think will be more successful with their customers. And, you know, they're trying to build that proverbial better mousetrap. And part of the problem is they're so good at it now, especially larger companies, but even some of the small startups are so good at innovating. They're so fast at it that they have outpaced their customers. So the competitive market does reward innovation. We see that all the time, but it's what the link that's often missing is connecting that innovation to the customer in a way that they're going to be ready to adopt it. So we're going to see that. I mean, if this isn't a linear trend, it's just going to get faster and faster.
Yeah, for sure. The rate of change is hard to keep up with. So how do we as innovators, whether we have a product, a service, whatever it is, how do we avoid that pitfall? Because that's a whole – I mean, there's, you know, one side of the not innovating trap, and then there's the other side of, well, when we innovate, this is what happens sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the great frustrations of really good companies is they work very hard to build better products, and then customers just don't see it, right? They just they stay with an older product, or they just don't see the need to switch to it. And I mean, that's not the Crystal Pepsi story. That's a simple story. Crystal Pepsi isn't really any much better than regular Pepsi, but in general, I think a lot of the innovations that we're seeing come to market are truly innovative. But the disconnect is connecting to customers, and how you do that, that's a really interesting area for research. So one of the things that we've been talking about is building in these enablers, making sure you explain to customers why you have this innovation. It's not just because we launch a new product every fall and every spring, but it's actually something better this fall or this spring.
Do you have an example of that? Because that – or like maybe one that you've seen in the marketplace, either from one of your research and work or just in your life that you look at and you go, wow, that could really use an enabler.
Oh, could really. Yeah. You know, so there's tens of thousands of new products launched every month, and we pay attention only to the ones that are successful. So it's hard to think about or even know of the ones that fail. So most of the ones that fail, nobody's really aware of.
Yeah.
Right.
That's true.
So I think you've had some really good examples already. We see a lot of it in consumer packaged goods because the innovation is really rapid there.
Yeah, right.
So, I mean, I'll probably steal your flax milk example.
I think that's a great one.
We had a slightly different one after we published the paper out of New Zealand. There was a guy who was selling a carbonated milk, which apparently is popular in parts of Asia. But he was trying to sell it in New Zealand and Australia. And the story he told us was that initially he had a very difficult time selling it. And in order to kind of make it schema congruent, he went the opposite way and made it sound like it wasn't tasty or normal right at the beginning. So he ended up calling it spider milk.
It was
quite successful because people were like, well, that's weird. I'm not sure I'd want to drink that. And when they drank it, it also was weird because it's carbonated milk. So still, you know, it kind of created a new schema, allowed him to break out from what people normally expect when they're drinking a milk-based beverage. So there are, you know, it's not always just as straightforward as saying it's environmentally friendly or it's healthier for you. Sometimes it's just finding a way to explain why it's different and getting its own, you know, creating its own niche in the market.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up. I'm having memories of a failed product launch I worked on a couple years ago here in the US, and it was apple juice with apple bits in it, very popular in Europe. But in America, right, we don't eat our juice. It's gross. Like, that's not a good thing. So, but the challenge was, is the brand team refused to own that. So instead, much to my dismay and fighting for it, I didn't win. They went to market with this, like, let's not talk about that. Let's just hide that. They'll find it out when they drink it. But then people didn't like it because their expectation was a portable juice. And then they got this thing with apple bits in it. And I desperately wanted them to own their difference and find the niche that that would work for, or make it just weird enough that people would go, like Altoids, right? Altoids is a great example. Yeah. When they first launched, it was weird, but they own their weirdness. I think that's kind of what I'm hearing you say is, like, when you're that different, also sometimes owning your difference helps set you apart from the competition too and sets expectations, right?
Yeah. So I actually heard a great story about a product that's being sold at a local farmer's market here. Just this morning on the radio, it fits in well in the example the kind of category you're giving here. And it is, so it was, they were on the radio and they had these, the hosts were going to eat this new product. And they asked them, well, what does it look like to you? They had it in front of them. It said, well, it looks like cookie dough with chocolate chips in it. And then they are like, okay, go ahead and taste it. And then as they were tasting it, they cut away to have the producers of the product explain what it was. And it was called Chicky Dough. So it's actually not cookie dough. It looks like cookie dough, but it's a vegan, gluten-free alternative that's made from chickpeas and carob.
Oh.
And as the person was explaining their product, I was like, oh, I want to try that. They're saying, you know, it tastes really good. It's like a dessert, but it's super healthy for you.
Yeah.
Then they cut back to the guys in the studio who had just tasted it. They thought they were about to eat some cookie dough, and they bit into some what they call dessert hummus, and they were both – both very unhappy with it.
Dessert hummus. That's not a good.
No, they did not enjoy it. And I don't think it's because the product was bad. And even they were saying, it's not that it tastes bad. It's just, I thought I was about to eat cookie dough.
Right. It's expectations.
Yeah. The texture was wrong. The flavors were different. They weren't bad. They were just wrong. So I think that's another problem is we try sometimes to say, like maybe is the case with flax milk as well, that, you know, we get people to say, okay, well, I'll try that. But then we set their expectations in a way that when they do try it, they are not likely to try it again.
Well, that was the challenge with this fruit drink. Great trial, no repeat. But I contend that it's because they didn't own it from the beginning. So people were freaked out when suddenly there were bits coming at them. So it just sounds gross. I actually enjoyed it once I got to know it. But, you know, you have to set expectations, right? I want to dig a little bit into the perspective you come from, because I find it fascinating and not your usual area of expertise or angle that, you know, you attack innovation from. So your work is in behavioral economics and experimental psychology. First of all, did I say that right?
That's right.
Okay, perfect. So first of all, explain what it is. And then if you could kind of elaborate on how as innovators that helps us be better at what we do.
Okay, so I'll try and do that quickly. That's a challenge for a professor. Yes.
We have a couple minutes. We're good.
But economics historically thought of people and modeled people as if they were rational decision makers. So they get all the information, they think about all the information, they make a rational decision. I think we all know intuitively we don't do that. So behavioral economics is really just incorporating what we know about how people actually behave into some of those more rational models to try and get models that are more not just predictive, but more realistic in terms of how people behave. The experimental psychology side is sort of the method I use to get at that. And I run experiments because what I want to understand is causation, not just what's correlated with what, but what causes certain behaviors to occur.
Which I think, and just very quickly, I'd say we often confuse.
Oh, yeah, all the time.
Yeah.
So, what people often don't realize is the only method that really gets at causation is experiments. So everything else that you do, and there's lots of good, we talked a bit about focus groups. There's no one perfect methodology, but all of them have flaws. So it's good to kind of combine them. But what experiments do that nothing else does is they get at causation. And so really my area is trying to understand the cause of economic decisions. What makes us do the things we do?
So that's fascinating to me. First of all, how did you get into that? Let me just quickly ask you that.
A bit of a long road, but ultimately what I tell people, and it's mostly true, is that I knew I wanted to go into science. I started as an undergraduate in science and, you know, I hated dissecting things and I killed all my fruit flies and I burnt everything in the chem lab. And finally I was like, you know what? Psychology is the one I'm really interested in and I'm not, I don't seem to be causing any damage here. And so I ended up in psychology. Then I went out, I worked after I graduated, I was broke, worked in finance for a while, came back and did a PhD. And when I did a PhD, it was interdisciplinary between marketing and psychology. So it kind of combined the two.
Well, and the thing that I want launch readers out there to really listen is, so when your comment about behavioral economics, about like economics was about kind of based on rational, but in the end of the day, particularly when it comes to buying decisions, we are not rational creatures at all.
No, and not at all.
Yeah. And I, you know, I had this great lesson. Do you know Lululemon, the clothing? The
course,
athleisure
yeah, great
wear.
Canadian
yes.
success.
Yes,
bar,
that's
yeah.
right. That's right. So I love them. But there was this moment where they put, you know, they have these great recycle bags that people love to kind of carry around as badge value because right. you know, it means you shop at Lululemon. So, and you can afford to shop
right.
at Lululemon.
Right.
But they, for a brief time a couple years ago, replaced their, they used to have their manifesto on their bag, which is like, you know, dance in the rain,
yeah.
spend time
yeah.
with friends, like all this stuff. And they placed it with Who is John Galt from Ayn Rand. From Atlas Shrugged.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, so right, exactly. So product didn't change, stores didn't change. That's it. The outside of the bag changed. That's it. And I remember texting a friend actually in Toronto to say, hey, can you get me one of those bags? I want to use it as an example for something. And her response back to me was in all caps, which is how you know it's serious over text. And she said, I will never shop there again after they put that on their bags. And I thought, what an irrational decision. Like it's
right.
not
right. –
the product hasn't changed. So to your point about kind of behavioral economics being a much better indicator of how we make decisions and kind of how that all plays out versus kind of, is this product better than this product? Because that's not really, I'm sure from your findings, ultimately what it boils down to.
No. And in fact, kind of as we were talking about earlier, a lot of it comes down to more of our emotional response than
yeah.
our thoughtful or cognitive response. And so when we're talking about new products, it's finding that balance between what makes people curious and what makes people anxious.
Mm.
That has nothing to do with, on the face of it at least, you know, what are the benefits or specifications of the product, right?
Right.
Are those Lululemon pants better than the Nike pants or the Under Armour pants? That's not what we're talking about in this example or in behavior in general. We're talking about what's the emotional response to that product offering and how does that change behavior? And that's ultimately what I spend my time studying.
So this may be a loaded question, but then how does understanding that emotional, that curious versus anxious, and that kind of and having that experimental approach, how does that help us become better innovators?
Well, at a really simple level, one of the things that behavioral economists have worked on recently is this notion of nudging. So we kind of don't push people, but we kind of nudge them towards certain behaviors. And that can work for innovators the same way it works for governments. I think in a bigger picture, it's about how do we understand how people make the decisions that they do. We know that people make decisions emotionally. Research now is also showing that we try to manage the way we feel with the way we consume. So we buy products to make us feel a certain way.
Yes. Sure.
And at the really cutting edge of some of the stuff that's happening in my lab and other people are looking at as well is, can we create emotions ourselves in order to drive ourselves towards certain behaviors?
Mm.
And often that's looked at in terms of self-control. You know, can I activate some emotion in order to avoid eating that second piece of chocolate cake or to get myself to the gym? So it's not just how we respond to products and how we manage our emotions by buying products, but it's also how we might even generate emotional responses in order to do certain things.
And do you think from a marketing perspective, that's kind of what marketing in general is all about? I mean, trying to elicit an emotion?
To a large extent. I mean, it's also true that there's some products we think a lot about, right? Some people might think a lot about a car that they buy.
Yeah.
People who are into fashion might really think about the dress or the pair of shoes they're going to buy. But in general, overall, emotion plays the dominant role.
Oh. And do you think this may be a hot, I don't know, topic to ask about, but like when you think about, I'd love to get your perspective on Nike and what they've been doing recently with the Kaepernick ads. And all of that. I don't even know what to ask. It just feels like the right thing to talk about. So I'm going to let you have the floor and tell me what to think about this.
Well, so I mean, politics aside.
Yes, that's what I'm trying to say. Like purely from a innovation and marketing
right.
and what we're talking about.
I mean, and I don't have any direct connection to Nike, so this is my external kind of view of it. But I think that was genius. I think essentially what they said is we need to connect with this younger market. We're not connecting with them the way we connected with people when Jordan was still playing basketball. You know, how can we do that? And they did it by creating a lot of attention.
Yeah. You know, and a lot of emotion.
And that emotion that people feel, you know, about this particular issue and Colin Kaepernick and the movement that he started, and it, especially, you know, among certain segments in the market, I think what they were able to do is take that emotion of the movement and connect it to their brand. And of course, there's a risk there. They're going to lose a lot of people.
Yeah.
But I think it's genius in the sense that this is a bet on the long term. And in the long term, the people that they're betting on are going to be the future of their company. And the people that they're really annoying are not really at the core of what they're going to do, even in 5 years.
And I would argue to add to that, that we are better eliciting a love and hate in the marketplace than indifference. And if you're playing in indifference, you're ultimately going to lose, which is kind of where they had been for a while there.
You can't, yeah, I mean, that's sort of marketing 101. You can't be everything to everyone.
Yeah.
Right? You have to pick your customers, even if you're as ubiquitous as Nike. But we were talking before about being in the boardroom and thinking about, you know, innovation, or in this case, positioning. I mean, that took some courage to make that decision to do it this way. And, you know, I also found the stock price got hit right away, but has since reached all-time highs.
Right, right.
So it's, you know, clearly it's a bet that paid off, but I bet there were some people who were pretty nervous.
Had some sleepless nights.
That thing. Yeah, well, I think so.
And what's been amazing to me to watch is the viral effect of it, not just the ad itself, but all the mock ads that have been created. So I can't tell you the number of people who have texted me Beaker from the Muppets, and it's like, meet, 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 just do it. Or like, you know, Darth Vader saying something, just do it. And I was like, wow, I have Nike imprinted on my brain, not just from the original ad, but from everything else that it's created since then.
Yeah. And we don't know a lot about what makes things sort of go viral, what makes people want to pass stuff on like that. But one of the things we do know is visceral emotion is key. Mm. And obviously the Kaepernick ads were visceral.
Yeah.
People had a really strong positive or negative response to it. And we know that gets attention, and that's what gets people to tell their friends about it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for going down that path with me. I think it's a fascinating case study in innovation from a positioning perspective.
Oh, absolutely.
To your point, politics aside.
Yeah. And we'll be talking about that in classes, I'm sure, for the next 5 or 10 years. It was quickly becoming a classic case study.
Yeah. Okay. So before I get to my last question, where can people go to learn more and connect with you?
Probably the best way is just my website. It's just kylemurray.com. So most of my articles are there. You can just download them for free. There's also a link to some of the books, which are not free, but maybe someday they'll be free. But for now, the publishers seem to want to charge money for them.
I don't know why. I don't know why, they do that. So this has been great. My last question for you is, what's the one piece of advice you have for launch readers out there? I'm going to change my question up from kind of what I thought I was going to ask. I want to know, like, what's the thing they should think about to end up in that right place in the schema? Because that really feels like we're the umbrella that encapsulates all of our conversation.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, in some ways, that's a question of how do you do marketing well in general, right?
Yeah.
And the generic kind of cliche answer is, what you want to think about first and foremost all the time is the customer.
Yeah.
And as cliche as that sounds, sometimes in product development, it's easy to get into the product instead. You spend a lot of time thinking about the product side and kind of thinking about the customer. But maybe the deeper answer or idea there is you want to think about how you can best explain that to your customer. And to do that well, and it's not always possible with all types of products, but to do that well, you really want to test it with real customers who are paying real dollars. Mm-hmm. So when you can test a product in the market, that's the ideal way to get that kind of feedback. If not, you have to rely on less direct types of market research to know your customers, whether that's focus groups or surveys or other techniques. But yeah, it's that focus on understanding your customer and what it is they need to know about the product. Because you're not going to have hours to explain it. You're going to have seconds.
Right. Like that woman at the vinegar who then just walked away super fast. And, you know, Launch Tutors listening, and I know they've heard this before. And in fact, I just had another interview where we dug a little bit deeper into this one thing, but you just said it. And I think it's so important, is that concept that, you know, the idea is really only as good as people's willingness to open up their wallets and pay for it. So you really don't know if something's going to work or even where the kinks are and the roadblocks or what is working until you see if people are willing to open up wallets for it. Because otherwise, like I'm sure you've seen this all the time in focus groups. I can't tell you the number of times I've been in there where they've said, oh, totally. But then the minute you go to market with it, there's massive resistance because it turns out they don't actually – they like the idea, but they don't actually want to pay for it.
Absolutely. And I mean, the classic case, they're environmentally friendly products.
Yes.
Market research, focus groups, and surveys, people will always tell you they will pay more for those products. On the shelf, they rarely do.
Yeah, rarely. And it's so funny. Many years ago, I finally got invited to participate in a focus group as a participant. And I may have lied about being in the business I'm in because I wanted to do it. So I wanted to know what that side was like. And it was all about water, your water usage. And if you cared about how much water you used and, you know, hot water and all that. And I went into it with a, oh my gosh, absolutely. Like in the focus group section of this research, I was like, yes, I care. Like I care about the environment. And I meant it. I wasn't lying.
Right. No,
I really
no.
meant it.
It's true.
But then I had to go wash dishes, a sink full of dishes. And it turned out I don't care.
Exactly.
That's, I was like,
and
oh.
That's the thing. It's where behavior kind of hits intentions.
Yes.
Things tend to change.
And don't you find – sorry, I'm going on a tangent a little bit. But don't you find too that in all that research, people don't – I wouldn't say they lie. I'd say they present their best selves, the self that they want to believe. It's just not always what translates into real world behavior.
No, that's right. And in fact, people rarely lie, straight out lie. Most people are instead affected by either a social desirability bias. They know the right answer is environmentally friendly is better. Or they it's something that they value. They just don't value enough to pay 15% or 50% more for it.
Right. And it's also relative too, I find. What we did ethnographies years ago for cereal. We were trying to figure out how to make cereal portable. And we recruited for I Live a Healthy Lifestyle, which relatively speaking, but you know, like not uber healthy, but like, you know, I care about my health. And I'll never forget being in this one woman's house and she's going on and on about how important health is to her as she's pouring sugar into her cereal, and there's a deep fryer on the counter. But as I got to know her, I realized she's not lying. This is healthier than how she grew up. So to her, this is healthy.
That's right.
Or to me, that's mortifying.
Yeah, I heard again, I think it was a podcast or radio, somebody's talking about, you know, asking someone from a poorer neighborhood, lower socioeconomic status about whether or not they eat salad. And the response was, yeah, I eat salad all the time. Every day I eat a lot of salad. And the follow-up question was, well, what kind of salad do you eat? Well, I eat macaroni salad.
Oh, like, right. Right. It's all relative.
With a lot of mayonnaise, macaroni and mayonnaise.
Right, but that's it's a salad.
Right. It was salad. So, yeah, I think I don't think people are lying to market researchers the vast majority of the time, but I think the way we're asking questions, we're asking about how do you envision kind of your ideal self?
Yeah.
Or how do you see yourself in the world? Not how do you actually behave in a specific instance, like exactly how much sugar do you use in a day,
right,
or how much salad do you eat.
Right, exactly. And I will totally own that when someone says to me, are you environmentally friendly? I'm like, oh God, absolutely. And I am in some areas. And then what I've really come to realize, in some I'm not. So
yeah.
It doesn't translate into everything.
I used to say I don't eat that much sugar until I actually tracked it and then realized I eat a lot more sugar than I thought.
Actually, it turns out I have like a whole pound a day. Just know that.
You know, I wasn't drinking soda and things that I was, you know, thought of as rich in sugar, but sugar's in all kinds of other things. And
right.
Yeah, when you,
right.
And then I kind of forgot about that piece of pie I had. And, you know, when you track it, you realize, and again, I wasn't intentionally lying to myself. I just didn't really know.
This has been fantastic. I could keep going on and on because I find behavioral economics and experimental psychology just so interesting and so important to kind of business and the work that we do, and really not getting to predictive results or decisions, but getting to ones that are smarter, really. So thank you. And we will put links to the books and all of that in the show notes as well for our audience because I'm sure they're going to want to go check them out. So Kyle, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Really enjoyed it. And we should do it again sometime.
All right. Hold up. Before you go, what did you think? I know I ask that every single time, right? I loved this interview. I love all of them, actually. As I've said before, I don't release the interviews if I don't think there's nuggets of gold in them for you and for me and for the Launch Street community. But here's the thing I want you to think about after this interview. I want you to think about what failures are out there that you can learn from. What Crystal Pepsis are out there. And then I want you to go out there, do some research on them, and learn from them and apply those lessons to your world. Here's the thing I want you to consider, though. I would like you to find those Crystal Pepsis of the world in industries that are not yours. I think sometimes when it's a direct competitor or kind of right in our line of sight, we actually get too myopic in our thinking. So I want you to go out and look at examples outside your category. Maybe they have something in common with your business. So, like, for example, if I was to go look at successes and failures, I might look at businesses that try to build community, because that's a part of what we do. I might go look at things like extreme sports. What did Tough Mudder and Spartan and those guys try that didn't work that I can learn from? I might go look at technology plays, because as you know, we have our Innovation Quotient Edge assessment and we have our IQE Pro Toolkit. All of that is technology based and actually building membership. So who is out there that's building a membership that I can learn from that's not in my category? And maybe that's looking at gyms or like a Massage Envy or, oh my God, everything is a subscription these days, right? So maybe I'll look at some of the subscription model businesses and things that they tried that didn't work. Do you get what I'm saying? You want to be outside your category with kind of a dotted line back so that it relates to you, but isn't in that direct myopic line of sight. You don't want to be looking at the same box, at the same information in the same way. You want to look out there and you want to look in different places for those nuggets. But those failures are great lessons for the rest of us. All right, Tamara out.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, launchstreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.